ventilator-associated pneumonia, elimination through infection prevention and treatment. My name is Paul Weber, and I'm glad that you have made the time to join us today. Our speaker, as you can see on the second slide, is Dr. Charles Palahniuk. You'll note that Dr. Palahniuk is a very lettered man. He's been actually a really productive man as well. He's held a number of academic and administration posts at the Indiana University School of Dentistry. He's been there for, I think, nigh on 30 years. He's currently the Director of Infection Control Research and Services at the school. Dr. Palahniuk has published more than 135 manuscripts, 285 monographs, 3 books, and 7 book chapters, the majority of which involve infection control in dentistry and related issues. To date, he has provided well over 100 continuing education courses for dental practitioners and other healthcare workers throughout the U.S. and in 9 foreign countries besides. Now, Syed Sattar once said to me that the best thing he could say about a man is that he has a good spirit. And from what I know about Charles Palahniuk, he has a very good spirit indeed, and it's an honor to have him with us. So to present the teleclass, Ventilator-Associated Pneumonia, Elimination Through Infection Prevention and Treatment, from the Indiana School of Dentistry, Indiana University School of Dentistry, pardon me, I am pleased to present Dr. Charles John Palahniuk. Dr. Palahniuk.
Thank you. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night, wherever you are. Let's go to slide 3, please. I wish this would be simpler, but we're going to have several problems, first of which is we're going to work on a definition. Because believe it or not, even though we have tremendous organization of everything, maybe we're overly organized in the United States, we do not have a commonly accepted, especially by the government, definition for this process. And so we're going to be working on that. But you can nibble around the edges, but the real need is that we're going to have to kind of figure this out for ourselves. Why? Because we have to figure out if we call the same thing and we define it the same way, then we can report it the same way. We are talking on the same levels, this type of thing. But as you can see from slide 3, ventilators come in all sorts of types, shapes, and services. Old people, young people, and everybody in between. Let's go to slide 4, ventilator-associated pneumonia. And this is one of my favorite slides, is you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. This is kind of the way it works in this process. There are ways we know that seem to make it better. Things go, get the counts and all the people being ill, those going down. In other words, the number of ventilator days and the people that are ill and develop some type of pneumonia, right, you can affect that. And you can affect it positively and very nicely. However, nothing works all the time for everybody. So, and on top of that, when we're going to talk about the arrows in our quiver, we're going to take on this process. There are lots of them, and no one really knows if they all work well or they work equally well or they don't work at all. A lot of things are tradition-based. So let's move forward now to the next slide. I'm looking at it says ventilator-associated pneumonias, and it talks about some numbers. Well, pneumonias of all types are serious. And now we have kind of, instead of nosocomial and all the rest of those words, we've kind of settled into, at least for this month, hospital-associated infections. And the number 2 type in the world, at least in North America I know of, is 11 to 15% of our pneumonias. Very serious. And obviously, if you're some type of intensive care unit, you're at even a greater disadvantage. And as you can see, pneumonias are 27% there. And we can then bump it up to the highest ones, generally something like coronary care, trauma, things of this nature. And you kind of exacerbate the problem by mechanical ventilation. Yes, we've just come and saved your life. But by the same token, we placed it at increased risk. Pick a number, 5, 10, 15% greater chance? No, 5, 10, 15-fold greater chance of having some type of a healthcare or hospital-associated infection just because you're being ventilated. If that does occur, it occurs, as you can see in the last slide, 10 to 25%. Now, what I'm going to tell you, there are good stories. I know small hospitals in the United States that have less than 25 beds are called critical access, kind of, you know, the regional ones. on the middle of nowhere. And then, of course, you're on the other side of the coin, you have very large medical center type things with thousands of beds. Both have achieved VAP levels of zero. There are ways that this can occur, and we have tremendous advances in this, even though we don't know how to count them. Next slide talks about the rates in varying ICUs, anywhere between 4 and 16 per 1,000 ventilator days. This is usually what we're going to go back and talk about surveillance. The 1,000 ventilator day seems to be somewhat sacred. Everyone kind of uses that to give you the denominator as for coming some kind of rate. The problem is with the numerator. Who gets to be counted and who really doesn't get to be counted? Who's left off and who's on? And as we go through the definitions, you may be mentally working on this yourselves, is to come up with your definition. Anyone be any different than anybody, so any better or worse? So I encourage you to think about that. What this does, if you do get VAP, it increases your chances of staying an extra time, an extra week of quality time spent in the hospital. Obviously, it also places you at risk for increased morbidity and mortality. And there have been 9 very large studies talking about VAP. And you can see just the presence of that type of pneumonia, ventilator associated pneumonia, has increased 20-50%. Now, there are other studies who show a wash, that people who have VAP do not have higher rates of mortality. And it's hardest, as you know, you're comparing apples and oranges in big hospitals, and one in this country and that. But in general, it is a serious, something that gets our attention. So the sad thing, of course, is that with certain types of care, certain types of approach, VAP can be prevented. VAP, those 6 days in the hospital, are not for free. Obviously, it increases cost, and the latest ones from the United States are $10,000 to $40,000. And then some severe cases can go up to $150,000. And so it is something for our attention. Let's talk about VAP infection prevention and control programs on the next one. And there's a lot of words here. I do that because of the fact I would like you to take away some printed things that you could then refer to. It's hard, I know, in a bulleted list of very short things to sit there and madly write. So I'm trying to take some of that frustrations out and make it a little easier, so we put more words than I normally use. So we're talking about what? We need an approach. Now, any organizational change requires what? Top-to-bottom care. In other words, everyone has to buy into it. People have to value the prevention and control programs, or else it's just not going to work. Also, to muddy the waters even further, there are many different components. There's many, many different ways of doing this. And some of them seem to have very good effects, and other ones seem, why don't they? And so it's hard to pick and choose what you're going to do, especially at a time when there's limited funds. You know, the CEO, the bean counters of the world are mad, and so we have to balance that. We want to prevent the infections, the pneumonias, at the most efficient manner. So some quality improvement initiatives suggest that cases of VAP may be prevented by careful attention to the process of care. That involves such things as what? Hygiene, hand hygiene especially, good infection prevention methods, you name it, the prudent use of antimicrobials, attentiveness like oral care. There's other types of very simple, straightforward processes that we can use that are necessary, and they do have results. We're talking about a complex problem. It's not like coming in and saying, oh, I know what you have. Take this pill and it will go away. It isn't that easy. So the next slide, we're talking about prevention, and brings up the idea of stewardship. And it's kind of like a nice, good buzzword. Another buzzword that we use in infection prevention in the United States is robust. Well, this is a robust process. We are going to focus on prevention related to VAP use. That's true. And we look at it from a kind of a large scope type of thing, that there are threats to a person who is intubated. Most of those threats, microbial, come from their own flora. Occasionally, however, they can come from what? On the outside, it can come from the hands of practitioners, which could be materials from another patient, you name it. So there is, there has to be a systematic change in our attitude, program, policies, and protocols. all of this has, it's not something you're saying, oh, we're doing all this work only for VAP. That's not true. You're doing it, if we do these things, there will be a broad brushstroke. Many things will happen. Many positive things can happen. Other healthcare associated, hospital associated infections will be positively affected. Now, what about this antimicrobial stewardship on the next slide? One component, and it comes from our own Centers for Disease Control in this country, and it's a campaign. And it's a campaign, well, I'll tell you a story. When I was young, I'm 62, we would go to Dr. Schultz, and my mother and I would be sick. And Dr. Schultz would look at me and say, oh, he has this or he has that. She always wanted to get a pill. Even though it was a viral infection, she wanted the physician, our family physician, to prescribe something. This was her mentality. And I thought, not knowing what, I was a little kid, not knowing any better, I now know what has happened because of the ramification of overuse, imprudent use of antimicrobials. Obviously, we now have more and more what? Resistant forms. So, yes, we want to be able to have antimicrobials as part of our process in here, but we do wish to be very sensitive to their use and the generation of resistant organisms. We will talk about bugs, and we'll talk about some microbiology in a little bit. Let's take a very simplistic, very straightforward definition one. And it has to do with hospital-acquired infections. A pneumonia, for example, is a patient. We're talking about a VAP. Okay, they're on some type of qualification. They're on mechanical ventilator support. This is not lung expansion. We're talking about tubes. By endotracheal tube, or as it says, a tracheostomy. And usually the magic point is 48 hours. It kind of tells you, yeah, they've been on this for these couple of days, and now they're sick. That kind of docks off the people who come sick or come intubated. And we're talking about folk that are intubated when they're in the hospital, a couple of days, they get sick. On the next slide, it talks about pneumonia definitions. One of the things that our CDC puts great stock in is that we will talk about different types or classes of pneumonia, especially how it occurs within a hospital situation. Of course, you can get sick at home. You can get pneumonia on a community-acquired basis. But healthcare-associated or hospital-associated in some cases is quite different. So VAP is a subclass of something that you get because of treatment or hospitalization. And you're on, again, we're deciding, they have to have some magical period of mechanical ventilation. So, in other words, oftentimes people will say, well, it's not really an infection unless you bacterial culture it. That's probably true, too. That helps a great deal. But what happens if the infection is hard to culture or is viral in nature, this is going to extend your time. Again, sometimes people have certain risk factors. We can talk about those. And the fact is that those place them at a greater risk. When it comes to the VAP, of course, the older you are, males have a much more difficult time with disease. Shame on you for smoking. The usual types of things. If we gave you a quiz right now, you could list the five top ones for sure. They're just behaviors that place us at higher risk. Let's go to the next slide about pneumonia definitions. We're going to call it this maybe after 48 hours of admission and intubation, and there's a culture present, and it's positive. And we kind of list what they can be. Generally, again, as I warned you before, these are endogenous. They're your flora. They're there rather than something that came from another patient or something you ate or something of that nature. But that can occur. Exogenous sources are not unknown. It's just that they're less common. Now, we want to see how long this can last. There's all sorts of qualifications you can see. These are important, I think, to when you're deciding what your surveillance is. What is going to be my numerator? Who gets to be counted and who is not counted? And you can go to the CDC website, and you can put the information there. You can go to the APIC website. You can hopefully get a hold of one of those elimination guys in VAP. There, we don't have to reinvent the wheel here. Many of the templates, many of the systems, Maybe the ways of reporting and calculating, counting, are already well-grounded. It just depends upon which one you pick. The next one on pneumonia definitions, it says HAP is pneumonia in which patient's first positive culture was obtained more than 48 hours after admission. There seems to be this, I don't know necessarily it's a blame game, but if it develops before that, it still can be a VAP. It's just that it may not be as associated for you being in the hospital. You probably came with that. But they take credit for after 48 hours. That seems to be a universal thing. Yep, it's one of ours. Now let's go to VAP definition number two on the second slide. Next slide. And here is a pneumonia, mechanically ventilated. Okay, we've been over that. Now we're going to introduce the concept of positive bacterial culture beyond 48 hours. So you're picking some type of what? rationalization or a checklist, a scoring method. Okay, mechanical ventilated, in the hospital, positive culture, 48 hours in the tank, and now they get to be counted. Now, many definitions of VAP differ from NHSM. NHSM is a reporting system, and it's part of or embedded into the CDC. So if I wanted to go to the CDC or look up something off of their website, I would use CDC, NHSN, and then VAP, and you'll get more than you ever bargained for. And if you have trouble sleeping, there's plenty of things you could read there that will help you greatly. Now, one of the things that they do there is they have their surveillance definition of VAP, but it's not well described. They're still fighting over this. The concrete is not dry, or the paint isn't dry. It's still in a state of great flux. Now, their definition is broader in the sense it doesn't have the 48-hour intubation ventilation. Pneumonia is pneumonia, and if it's ventilator-associated, then it becomes VAP. Let's go. VAP definition number three. Pneumonia is identified by using a combination of radiologic, clinical, laboratory criteria. Now we're making it more complex. It's not a value judgment by a physician chair side. A bedside. You're involving all sorts of talented people, radiologists, clinical people, lab people, so the definition becomes even more discerning, hopefully, or does it become more demanding and more difficult to solve? Because you can never get 10 people in the room and get the same definition of VAP. It's kind of like, my, this is a good wine. Well, everyone has different opinions about it. And this is the same thing with this. This is an evolving topic. So we do know how there are some common themes. Again, mechanical ventilation, high risk, using the old term, nosocomial. It does happen. It places you at risk. And one of the things the CDC wants to do, very desperately, they want these to be counted. But if you're in a hospital in Piggly Wiggly, Indiana, this is tough. Does the person have VAP? Do they not? All sorts of classifications. And then your system of reporting that to internally oftentimes is very different than the one that other systems, your state, your city, your county, your town, whatever, or your government, in this case the federal government, reports. And that frustrates preventionists, people who work in hospitals, a great deal. Because doing the report is not what frustrates them, makes them angry. It's the fact that I have to do the dang thing four different ways for the same information. Why can't we agree on this? I guess we just can't agree on some things in the world. I suppose that's why there's chocolate and vanilla ice cream. HNSN definitions also include something, an expansion, and they really key in on this. You can find more information on this on their website, a lot of places, about do they have pneumonia? That's kind of a one. Do they have pneumonia with laboratory findings? That's a two. And people who have immune suppression, HIV, drug suppression, you name it, are in class 3. This does help somewhat. I mean, it does clarify things a little bit as to what's going on. Do you have pneumonia by diagnosis, or do you have pneumonia plus diagnosis plus laboratory findings? So it does help define or segregate or categorize things just a little bit. The next chart, as you can see, it's the mother of all algorithms. This is presented on the website. It's in the APIC books. It's in a lot of places. If you sit down and just look at this, is this something that I want to do? Is this something that I want? If you're going to pull in laboratory signs and symptoms, so you have clinical diagnoses and x-rays, this is hard. These are interrelated. And sometimes if you say yes, you go one way, and no, you go the other way. This is difficult and it's expensive. The key thing here is that can we agree on something that is practical, minimal, so that we can move on? That's hard to do. In an era where people want only the best or the most demanding and we want to improve everything, it's hard to come up with something that is simplistic. If you sat down and you thought which of these are absolutely essential, it's hard to do. But can you go with just a diagnosis of chairside? Sure, I suppose. It just depends upon what demand is placed upon you. And the difficulty is, the more demanding it is, let's face it, your level of compliance is not going to be as high. This is a pain. Do I really want to do this? I'm already reporting it internally in one way or another. Now, to do this whole thing all over again and go through this roadmap of what Southeast Asia or someplace, this is tough. Going from island to island in Greece, geez. I'm glad I'm in a dental school. A more simplistic outcome or presentation is this one. If you're trying to create a system or a philosophy or a discipline of safety, in other words, patient safety is extremely important. And if you're going to get into the fact that we're going to try to prevent things from happening, not treat them after they've occurred, you can use something that looks a little bit like this. It falls into three pots: device associated, process or procedure associated, and, of course, medication. Now, obviously, not all patients are the same. So some of this has to a little bit depend upon the patient's qualification. What are they like? But these are the things that you're going to inflict upon them. If you have medications, obviously antibiotic use is extremely important, but you have to be very careful. If you're talking about procedure-associated type of thing, one of the key things that we always talk about is post-surgical wound infections. Trying to keep those low. Those hospitals are constantly sending out surveys, finding out what happens after surgery and dismissal. So you have something at surgical site, and, of course, post-procedure pneumonias may occur also. Let's go over to the devices. In many ways, are these errors that should never occur? Well, I mean, right now, these forbidden or no, never occurrence, or should never occur type of events, such as improper medications or things of that nature, well, should every surgery be perfectly acceptable and perfectly pristine afterwards? What about devices now? Let's go work on them. Central lines, big problem. Major problem. Let's face it, you're catheterized. It not only feels funny, you're in a different perspective. The fact is that all of healthcare is reviewing how long people should have what? All sorts of central lines. Okay. And catheters. These types of things. How long they leave them in? For some people with central lines, it's a long time. For catheters, oftentimes you make a decision every 24 or 48 hours. As for dialysis treatment, that's a whole different kettle of fish, and it's not nearly, it's more dependent on being separating yourself from things like endotoxins. But let's get down to ventilator-associated pneumonia and going to the next slide. This is really what we're after today. We're addressing this as a device-associated problem, and that's true, because you can be the same person without the device, and your chances of getting a pneumonia are almost, let's face it, many-fold fewer. This is saving your life, helping you recover, whatever, and it's placing you at risk also. Let's go to definition number four, VAP definition number four. Patients needing mechanical help to breathe are at high risk for hospital-acquired pneumonia. Okay, central truth. Reporting of VAP would be phased in when the standardized definition developed. Ooh. A standardized definition will make sure that hospitals are reporting the exact same event and will allow comparisons between hospitals. This is actually on the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control website. they're saying, yep, they understand it exists, and they have an idea of why and where and how. But until we get our stuff together here, we all agree on a good definition, a practical definition, one that everybody can do, I don't know if they really want to count them. It's tough. A standardized definition remains elusive. Let's put it that way. Let's go to our Canadian friends. This was an article that I came across about, correct me if I'm wrong, if these have changed. This is a rather nice review, as it says, consolidating the evidence. It has to do with how another group looks at it, a group of people. So, again, they bought into the, yes, this is a hospital-acquired pneumonia. It's not present when you come in. You're not intubated when you come in. But after intubation for 48 hours, you have some problems. And they define as more people are coming to. Also, there's an early onset and a late onset of this. In other words, you can go for a couple of days and have no problems at all. And other people become somewhat ill afterwards. We'll find out that seems to be microbiologically based. And we'll define those and give you some ideas. What bugs seem to cause early onset and what bugs seem to cause late onset? And there's no mixing and matching. There's no overlap there. In fact, there seem to be almost a different set of flora. And again, they consider it and call it ventilator-associated pneumonia and being a subset of hospital-acquired pneumonias. Again, what they want, the minimum, again, is 48 hours. Everyone is evolving. It's not a problem. In that sense, we're all trying to do the best that we can do. Now, let's talk about infection and immunity. Not everybody has the same response to any type of challenge, whether it be microorganisms or anything in your life, toxins, you name it. Everyone responds differently. And again, what we're talking about here primarily is you're taking on a set of flora that normally is not problematic. In other words, bugs that are in your saliva, bugs that are on your tongue, these types of things are on your skin. They're not normally problematic. They've come to some accommodation. However, when you change the equation, you change the balance. For example, with fungal infections, when do they occur? Well, when you change the balance. Burns, diabetes, you name it. You can list all of those factors that things are, in essence, out of whack. And that's what happens here, that this intubation, this prosmechanical ventilation, causes your normal flora to say, Jesus, time. This is kind of interesting. Let's try our luck. Now, normally, your body, the lower parts of your lungs are sterile. And you have a good immune system and there's phagocytic activity, and all of those things are positive. Human saliva has enzymes that kill bugs. Human saliva has IgA. Your serum has IgG. All of these things. So what types, why is it so special now to place you at higher risk? And there are a number of reasons when that occurs. Oftentimes you may not even be, in essence, awake. You may be sedated. So salivary flow is different. Clearage is different. You're just a different functioning entity because it's placed you at greater risk. Even though you have the same immunity that you had before, you're still at increased risk for infection. Let's go to the next one about infection. Immunity talks about factors that may interfere. There's lots of them. And the same thing is what? Alcohol, cigarettes, co-infections, viruses, other types of bacterial infections, for example, the tubes, all sorts of things. You just, the list goes on and on and on. That could be compounding factors that somehow have an ability to go around the normal response system. Obviously, if you're older and you're male, this seems to put you in the booth no matter what you're doing. Of course, then there's other things, people that are not have good nutrition, immunosuppression, mechanical obstruction, it just goes on. The fact is that one of the key factors in any type of infections, especially orally, is the fact that many drugs, especially when cardiac drugs, affect salivary flow. And that is collectively called xerostomia, which can be partial or complete. In this case, inadequate salivary flow, intubation happens. It just, you stop salivating as well. You don't salivate, you don't have all those goodies that are in saliva, your clearage goes down, it places you at higher risk. It allows colonization. So what you're having here is almost you're saying, well, we're pioneering. We're forming biofilms in an area that normally didn't exist, and that's what's happening. Let's go on again with infection immunity. It talks about advanced age. There's no fun in growing old. You're only supposed to be, when you're old, you're supposed to be happy, I don't know what. But most of the people that I know, I consider to be old, know the glass is no longer half full. And there's going to be what? This places you at a disadvantage. Immunologically speaking, there's many people, and I happen to be one of them, think that middle age, over the hill for males, occurs, immunologically speaking, around 18 or 20. After that, it's all downhill. It's a little later for women. The fact is that your body tends to what? Not respond as quickly or as well as robust. It just doesn't happen. We tend to forget things, and we tend to forget to respond to. Obviously, as we get older, perhaps we can call this some form of immune suppression. It could be disease, treatment, you name it, infection. They all gang up on us that our response is not as good as it once was. Now, people who are intubated also fall into the category of being, using probably a bad term, they're more sick, they're sicker, they tend to be oftentimes critically ill. And so that places them at even greater risk. Now, we can talk about those risk factors as being modifiable. Are there things that we can do or non-modifiable things? There's nothing we can do about this. The risk factor is present. We just have to deal with it. As well as patient-related as to treatment-related. Obviously, I think that how long you're going to live except you get run over by a bus is predetermined at the moment of conception. Good point, 60-70%, and the rest of it's up to us. Do we exercise? Do we smoke cigarettes? Don't smoke cigarettes? What is our diet? All of this comes into play as to our friskiness, our robustness, our ability to deal with society and infections. So many patient-related behaviors, be they for fun, alcohol, lots of alcohol, lots of tobacco, or are they work-related? Do you work in an area that places you at increased risk versus treatment-related? So ideally what we're after here in healthcare are those things that we can modify, especially those that are treatment-related. Oftentimes things that people do to ourselves, there's not much we can do about that. Now back to the topic of early and late onset. This is interesting because early onset is the first day for 4 days. And you can see you have certain organisms, Haemophilus, or strep pneumonia, these types of things. They're there. And there seems to be the problem children right then. Shame on them. But there they are. Late onset occurs kind of after 4 days. And you have a different flora. Now all of a sudden you have what? Acinobacter, Pseudomonas, Enterobacter, even some MRSA thrown in. That has not been well studied, at least as far as I can find. But it's true. It exists that you have. But if you look at biofilms in your mouth, for example, plaque, if you don't brush your teeth for one day, I can tell you what kind of organisms are going to be there. They're going to be more facultative, anaerobes, more aerobic organisms, things like that. As the plaque ages and becomes older, remodeling of that biofilm occurs. It becomes more aerobic, more acidic, for example. And you'll see a change in the flora to things that are gram-negative. So why not, if it occurs on your teeth, why couldn't that same phenomena occur south, further down the pipe? And the fact is, you have a transition. Maybe this is a true, what would you call it, remodeling type of mentality. But it's been serious. Obviously, Staph aureus, we'll find out, is the most commonly cultured organism. It's very common. Again, wherever you're at, I'm not sure MRSA is present on lots of people, but it's exacerbated or made worse by IV drug abusers. There's all sorts of other things. On the next slide, it goes on to thermal injury, wounds, and things of this nature. Obviously, if you've had poor antibiotic therapy, in other words, over-therapy, perhaps, or a prolonged stay in some type of intensive care unit, you're going to put you at risk here. These puppies are going to come get you. Compared to patients with VAP caused by MRSA in this case, MRSA, people tend to be older. In the process, they've been longer in the hospital. And they're more likely to have, as it says, chronic lung disease. So there are ways that human behaviors, much less what healthcare personnel inflict upon them, tends to cause different flora to be present. Let's talk about some microbiology in the next slide. This seems to be a recurring theme. If we go into VAP patients and we do isolation throughout the whole period, early and late, the most commonly found organism is Staph aureus. Well, it's on our skin. Now, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, where might that come from? That might be more exogenous. It might be. The other ones you could possibly have as present of our flora, and maybe fecal oral routes. Obviously, about, pick a number, 20%, 25% of people have candida in their mouths at all times. So there are trends here. Popular organisms that seem to have the capacity to do this. Now, on the next slide, we have a table for you. We've parsed these out. These are the bugs that, if you're saying, and there will be a quiz, of course, and early onset ones are these three organism types. They're commonly found after the first 4 days. After day four, surprise, the change, a remodeling. Other organisms are present. And if you, again, what I've listed for you on the right-hand side, this is gleaned from the previous slide to make some comparison. These are the organisms of concern. Where do they come from? Why are they present? Well, they just are. And so this type of situation, this opportunity, this situation where things have changed seems to favor their growth. Let's go to the summary of epidemiology and pathological points. The incidence of VAP is 3 to 10 times greater than pneumonia in non-ventilated patients. That's serious business. That should get your attention. Very serious. VAP occurs in 28% of patients undergoing mechanical ventilation. Very, very common. In healthy individuals, normally the lower respiratory tract is sterile. It shouldn't have this. It should not occur. This is odd. The body possesses defense mechanisms to prevent this. It should not, under normal conditions, but you're not normal anymore. There's something, some things that have changed. Not only is there some disease, there are treatment modalities, some of the things that your personality realize, what you've done before, kind of either help or hurt you. Let's go to the next slide, again, continuation of the summary. Mechanical ventilation is the prime risk factor for development of VAP. Why? The endotracheal tube acts as a conduit. Hey, I'm going places where man is not supposed to go. And so it's a different mentality. This places you at risk. Secretions, again, you have the cuff or the connection to the outside. Can that leak? Sure. Can bugs from the outside or from other parts of the peroral flora, peroral area can come down? You betcha. Sedation of patients or mechanical event inhibits their ability to clear secretions. I think it's a big factor. And we'll come when we talk about what we're going to do about this sedation, lightening sedation, wean them off, trying to eliminate it as much as possible, seems to be a very, very positive thing. So that must be one of the arrows in our quiver that we want to keep in our bundle. Patients undergoing mechanical ventilation are frequently fed. And so we will find out that not only is there propensity for aspiration, but the very food itself can be very problematic. We don't want gastric distension. That causes a lot of problems. People who get gastric ulcers because of this become worse cases, and it's just a sliding down the hill, and we can't stop. So a lot of things we have to pay attention to. Further in the summary, critically ill patients are unstable. Let's face it. They're tough. They're in a tough situation, and one of the things we'll talk about as a possible way of helping the problem is positioning the patient, especially their head. Activity is frequently limited during mechanical ventilation. It appears, and this is the thought, that if you can get them up and move them around, even though they're ventilated, It seems to help a great deal. Just laying in bed like a, you know, like a dead tuna does not help. So if you, in any way, shape, or form, those patients that are up for this or can do this or could be allowed to do it, it appears that some type of activity is beneficial. VAP, as you can see, there is a relationship from having intubation. The longer you are, the worse it gets. But generally, that, the fact is, it's going to occur, and it's around that four-day period. If you're intubated for 4 days, if it's going to occur, it is, then it's coming to visit you by then. Again, since it's mostly bacterial, we have to be very concerned about anybody who is immunocompromised in some way. So the colonization of oropharynx and, of course, dental surfaces, hard and soft tissues, is that reserve. You're constantly what? That's why you have to brush your teeth every day or twice a day. That's what we ask. Brush twice, floss once. That you have to get rid of it. You never can totally eliminate the organism. You can only somewhat beat them into submission. And so now you're not brushing, you're not doing anything, and your salivary flow is poor, your clearage is at risk, and you're ill profoundly, and you can see why this becomes a multifactorial serious infection. Let's practice what we've learned. Frequent ask question number one. If a patient is intubated pre-admission, should we determine if they are a VAP? And as you can see in the answer, if they come in intubated and they are what appear to be symptom-free, it meets all the other criteria, then what? If a patient was intubated and received care at another hospital and subsequently transferred to your facility, then you need to do the 48 hours. Only pneumonia is appearing 48 hours after admission belong to you. So yes, in other words, they can come in intubated if they're symptom-free. That doesn't count until 48 hours. Then it's yours. Question two, if VAP occurs within 48 hours, is it still considered a VAP? Yeah, it kind of is. That's the federal, our U.S. government telling us that. Most of the time, the 48 hours is a very important threshold that we want to pay attention to. But it can and does occur before, or soon after intubation. What's the minimum time frame? Again, since we can't agree on that, there is none. You have to consider that being somewhat spiritual, that anything that you write down probably could work. Do we call it a VAP if the patient aspirates? If a patient is symptom-free and is obvious aspiration at the time of intubation, you got it. It belongs to your hospital. Whatever happens to them, generally, they come in and they don't seem to have any symptoms. They're intubated 48 hours later or not. If it occurs on your watch, it belongs to you. What is a good definition? This is funny. It's a pneumonia. Occurs in patients intubated and ventilated at the time of or within 48 hours before the onset of pneumonia. I rarely have a VAP as defined by 2. In other words, 2 and 3, if you remember, are 2 is pneumonias plus laboratory. So they're telling you, yes, we do have pneumonias, but we do them clinically. We determine them clinically. Or 3 has to do with immune suppression. What am I doing wrong? Well, you haven't done anything. Give yourself a break here. In general, the majority of VAPs identified through surveillance fall into 1. In other words, it is physician-driven diagnoses, that type of thing. Much more simplistic, straightforward, and that's nice. It doesn't mean that you can't use this three-headed beast to classify what you do. Just the fact is that you should not feel guilty about it. That's the way it works. Obviously, if laboratory tests can support what kind of therapy you can use. Question 7, why do we use 1, 2, and 3? Well, this includes all pneumonias. All pneumonias that should be tracked, at least. It does involve things like chest x-rays, as you can see, signs and symptoms, where 2 is you got lab, all that plus labs, and 3 is all that plus acknowledgement of immunocompromise. Last question here, 8, is it best to give a chest x-ray? A lot of people, there's a lot of different reasons and why people have a problem and with that. If you're looking for something that's new or you have any concerns, obviously, There's no underlying disease. There's no smoking gun, if you will. There's no previous x-rays that you can take a peek at. Yeah, probably a good idea. It helps, let's put it that way. It helps you define clinically what the disease is, especially in pulmonary cardiac diseases that becomes very muddy. It's more difficult. Sometimes compounding factors are involved. So you may have to use a series of x-rays in order to get that done. Let's talk about risk assessment. This is a template. This is not, these are not something that is sacrosanct. No. This is just one organization of what to do. And you give yourself points and you kind of look at, what risk are you? What is this? Does your facility, your organization collect data related to that? And one of those things is, how well do you wash your hands? Do you wean or interrupt sedation on intubated patients? Can you just don't take it for granted, but you try to think whether you can get the patient to wean them into lower level of sedation or off? We're going to talk about positioning in a little bit. Do you do oral care? I happen to like to call it oral hygiene, but they call it oral care at hospital. If so, do the results of these data demonstrate compliance? Well, if hand washing compliance is 42% on average, we have some problems. That if you're dealing with these types of patients, compliance must be higher. Are the results of the measures reported to senior leadership, nursing leadership, and care providers? Everyone has to buy into this. This should be a source of pride. In other words, together, using a set of procedures and processes and equipment and chemicals, and a lot of labor, our VAP score went to zero, and it's remained for zero for 4 months. This is a source of pride, and this has to be sold in that package because obviously everyone is asking for their share. Everyone wants more. That's tough. Are there written policies, protocols, or pathways to describe recommended practice? If there's no standard operating procedure or something that's almost knee-jerk, and the fact this is what we do in our facility, do we kind of just wing it? It's kind of like going to a concert and having a seat with a ticket number on it versus festival seating. Is it kind of free form? Well, we know that if you put in writing and you practice it and everybody understands it, it may well get done. Now, let's talk about surveillance. Now, one of the key things here about surveillance is, again, let's go back. I'm getting all screwed up here. There we go. This is some representative data from some facility. Now, again, as I indicated to you, the denominator usually is 1,000 either hours, or you can make it into days. It's some type of thing that usually revolves around the number of 1,000. Who gets in and who gets to be counted, again, is the muddy part. But here's some. You can see they've had some VAP cases. They didn't have some VAP cases. And you can see how many days people that were on ventilators in this facility, you can actually come up with a VAP rate. You had two people, 100 days, blah. And then you can also then divide it down into quarters. One of the things when we talk about you starting this up or you continue it or everything else, you have to have something called a daily goal. This is hard. To do all of these things in a cooperative method is not easy. So you have to have little victories. And it's a pain. And sometimes it's almost counterproductive. Some people think the fact is that you have to have daily goals. Today, I'm going to do my best, and we're going to have nothing. Wonderful. But then if you then stretch this out for monthly, you can see there's going to be that same data set, tremendous variation, ups and downs, versus something if this was all just linear. And again, it's not that the government doesn't think it doesn't exist. It just should exist at an incredibly low rate, less than 2. Let's do that on a quarterly basis on the next slide on surveillance. And you can see it makes pretty diagrams. Whatever it's telling you, you thought you had very few, but in comparison to what the real goal is, where you wish to be, even by government standards, well, we need to improve something. Now, how can we prevent this? Well, there's a number of strategies here. We'll go through them a little bit. They all have merit, and they all have value. How much, or should you keep them, or should you do them? Well, something to talk about. We call this collectively a bundle. You could use the arrow and the quiver analogy. I, being a foodie, I'd rather talk about spices, making a tremendous curry or something on it. So what curries, what flavors, what spices, whatever essences do I put into my world-class green chili curry? Well, that can vary. Are they all effective? I think so, of course. Are they equally effective? Probably not. Could I take one out if I didn't have it and it still tastes the same? I don't know. I've never tried that. That's the real issue here. Because we're dealing with human beings and we're dealing with lots of money and lots of labor. It's difficult. Let's look at some of these just as a very general, straightforward thing. One of the things people talk about is elevating 30 degrees. Well, if you can't elevate them and the patient doesn't bend very well, then you can use a what's called a reverse Trendelberg. In other words, instead of elevating the feet, you're elevating the head. They're flat. That's helpful. People think that it's been shown to be very positive influence. But let's do a real life experience. Let's go to this hospital in Rochester, New York, and we'll talk about them. This is their the way they approach themselves. And if you look at it, it tells you that it's a 700-bed tertiary care, and it has certain transplants, and it has certain ICUs. So, you know, there's some risky business going on here. On the next slide, it talks about ventilator bundles. This is what it does. We elevate their heads. We try to give what they call sedation vacations. The fact is, can you wean them? Can you turn it off for a while to the point where they are cognizant or they're fully awake? Does that help? Well, it appears from all the data that that is a positive thing. I don't know about necessarily about what prophylaxis, these types of things for deep vein thrombosis, that's a problem, of course. They're laying flat for extended period of times. Peptic ulcer prophylaxis, and we'll talk about using all sorts of different chemicals because once there's distension, because of lots of different reasons, mostly nutrition, you can get ulcers, and it's really a problem. It really increases your chances of having a severe outcome. And again, it's a pain, but we have to do it every day. We have to assess certain things, and one of which, again, is readiness to wean. Because it appears as soon as you get them off of that, or as soon as you can lighten the load, you're going to be happy. Now, they have other ones from oral care, and we'll talk about those in a moment. But there's going to be some pushback. Not everybody's going to say, gosh, this is wonderful. And one of the big pushbacks in any healthcare facility are physicians. Part of that has to do with organizational change or organizational management. You got to sell this. You got to prove that it's valuable, that the labor and the equipment and the whole process works. So they have to get the physicians to buy into this. And again, that daily goal sheet is time-consuming. You got to fill it out. But that's really proving that you're doing it day in and day out. Now, of course, physicians say, well, I never do that. Well, that's true. There are individual practice preferences that may butt up against what you want to do. Again, the data, the results, the positiveness of these types of bundle characteristics, bundle players, has to be shared and known. Staff members are not immune from this. This is something else I have to learn. I don't know. This seems to be a lot of work. Does it work? Most people, if you can show to them that there's going to be a positive result, we didn't have any VAP this month, we'll buy into it and understand it. So these are very natural human things that we have to think about. Keys to success, at least in this facility, get the key players. If the chiefs, whoever the big cheeses are not buying into this, there's going to be a problem. This has to be a continual process. Continual quality improvement. We have to be modeling thinking. Does it work? What to keep? What to throw away? Senior leaders have to be involved with it, of course. Directors, these types of things. Full support, full Monty, because this is quite an effort. And again, there has to be what? Extra bennies. In other words, there has to be some type of assistance for this. You have to address reasonably and efficiently, effectively, the resistance to change. It sounds like more work to me. Well, that's true. But how does this extra work produce positive results? Oh, we always have these things. They last for about 2 months and they all go away. Well, if this one's going to work, it should never go away. Let's talk about prevention strategies. And there are some here. What about reducing colonization? Obviously, if we keep the biofilms at bay, that can help a great deal. There are ways to do that. And of course, one of the ways of colonization, a good site externally, is hand washing. So in other words, if there's good infection prevention qualities going on, well, especially in hand asepsis, before and after contact, all these other things, that's a positive thing. What about the endotracheal tube itself? Well, you know, that's a 6 to 21-fold increase in risk just by having that tube in there. And again, what about using things that, tubes that have materials that are anti-biofilm? In other words, they resist biofilm formation. Are they clean processes? Are they disinfected processes during use and these types of things? So how often are things, the secretions, removed? And there are lots of different things. Again, yeah, these qualities or these tenants can be found on many websites, including the one APIC, the one from the CDC. Contamination means exogenous. If we can keep outside sources, not just hands in this case, but actual fomites, pieces of equipment, other types of things, possibly even food, that will help greatly in the sense of doing things. If you're going to what? Rinse a reusable respiratory equipment, why not use straw water, for example? Remove the condensate from the ventilator circuits. There's lots of very, I think you sat down and you thought about it for a moment, could come up four or five things very easily. Again, decreasing duration of intubation seems to be something that absolutely works. Considering in the United States, the average ventilation is $1,600 a day, just because you're being ventilated, on top of all the other things. So it's an expensive process. So the sooner we can get you off of this thing, not only is it better economically, if possible, it also has a profoundly positive effect on preventing the VAP from occurring. Positioning, we already talked about that. The fact is that something between 30 and 45 degrees, that seems to work pretty well. There's elevating the head, probably just make things move along a little faster. What about nutrition? Well, again, you're talking about people being oftentimes fed through tube, and what you feed them is important because any type of distension can be very problematic. So you want to avoid gastric over-distension. You can do that a lot of different ways. There are some pretty stiff drugs and all sorts of other things. But obviously, you want to keep the stomach process and then the tubing that comes afterwards the happy as possible. There are some people who do get small bowel feedings, and again, that seems to work better, believe it or not. In fact, if you feed them directly into the small intestine, this has a smaller effect on the development of VAP. Again, mobility, it appears, if possible, if you can get them to do some moving around, it seems to be very, it helps prevent bed rest-related complications. Let's just put it that way. Technology, again, biofilms are what we're after here. And if we can have materials or methods or whatever it takes, that's it. We can have better materials. Now, gastric juices, again, what I indicated to you, the fact is that the pH level in the stomach has to be monitored carefully. We don't want distension by using improper foods. We also want to prevent, if at all humanly possible, the formation of gastric ulcers. Again, we talked about sedation level. Wonderful. It's great to try and think about that. Let's get down to oral hygiene. Oral hygiene, in case, is just not teeth. In other words, part of what you inherit is how good the person's teeth are to begin with. If they have caries development, open wound, these types of things going on, That's going to be problematic. It's going to give you a higher point score. So in other words, if the person comes in and they're relatively clean, have good oral hygiene and all that kind of stuff, give a score of 1. What about the tongue? Is it pink? Can we scrape it? Can we keep it clean? It doesn't look coated or in fact, even emitting blood or things like that. So let's give that a 1, too. What about the lips? Are they smooth? Do they look normal? These types of things. Another 1, that'd be the hope. And what about the mucous membranes both inside and around the lips and this type of thing? Well, do they look normal? Are they pink and moist? So anytime we can keep the score below 8, we have cut our time that we have to do in oral hygiene in half. In other words, if we have higher risk levels, 9 or above, then we have to do this every 2 hours, do something. Well, what are we going to do? Let's go to the next slide on oral hygiene. It talks about different activities and different days and different times. Brushing teeth is important. Yeah, you've got to brush teeth. Provide oral care every 2 or 4 hours. That usually seems to be what people are doing now. Apply moisturizers around the mouth. Just keep everything very supple. Very nice. Are you doing suction orally if necessary? Okay. Are you using other types of medicaments, these types of things? One of the things I can tell you when it comes to someone else taking care of another person's mouth, it goes back many years, as I was once young. The fact is that we were in an institution where there were mentally and physically handicapped children, and their oral hygiene and everything else was terrible. But they had an attendant who was supposed to take care of this. And nothing seemed to improve it. So what I did, I said, enough. We're going to have a clinic. We set up a clinic in that hospital ward for the caretakers. And we found out that they didn't care about their mouths very much at all. So how can you expect them to take care of someone else's? So once we started cleaning them up, once we started providing them free dental care, we actually got their oral hygiene IQ above 2, things got better. If they valued their oral cavities, they would value their patients. In a hospital situation, there's always a debate who should do this. In many cases, it's an RN. And even though they're wonderful life forms, and I know they're going to get mad at me, RNs know much about dentistry as physicians do, and most of those people see dentistry with their eyes closed. They're not as familiar as they could be. What does it take? We have produced a 4-hour course with technique building. That's all it takes. Then you're up to speed and you're on your way. Then it's up to your motivation. And on the next slide, it talks about chlorhexidine. This is the wonder drug. Abyss biguanide was originally used as a udder wash for cows. It has now been used for many years as a mouth rinse. And this does not cause resistant forms. This is kind of like super glue or tape. These things don't necessarily kill organisms. They just stick them together and you swallow them or you suck them out. Chlorhexidine works extremely well on clean surfaces. So if the patient has a clean oral cavity, chlorhexidine works marvelously well. It does not have a good shot on going through plaque. If the mouth is not as hygienic as you want it to be, it will be less effective. So let's talk about some key strategies and wrap it up here. Going a little over. Hand hygiene, basic infection prevention strategies. Minimize the use of antibiotics. Use some type of antiseptic mouth care, variety of treatments as you can see. Try to minimize aspiration as best you can. Again, shorten the time of ventilation, weaning, optimal use, sedation, vacations. Keep the changing of the materials to the absolute minimum. Get rid of the condensate, disinfect. You can store respiratory therapy equipment quite well. It should be done well because it is reused. There's plenty of good protocols for that. Avoid gastric distension if possible. And then on the next slide, educate healthcare personnel who care for patients. And I cannot, if you wish this to be successful, for me, from my experiences, this is the key. You have to win their hearts in order to win the battle. Because this is not, did I go to school to do this? Well, I did, but you didn't. The fact is that it's demanding. But it can give you such wonderful results. And again, you want to look at all of the whole process, this global combination, your bundle, and make sure it's all working. unfortunately, you have to monitor that on a daily basis. Regular surveillance, and it could be a wonderful trip to go into the CEO's office and say, we have not had a VAP for 3 months. Wow, that's tremendous. 2 years ago, APIC changed the mentality. We no longer control infections. We prevent them. To control means that 80% of the people got sick and now 20%. That's not bad. But what's wrong with zero? If we have a zero tolerance to infection, then we're talking about the term prevention. And that should be our ultimate goal. Not just to have, we reduced it by 8%, we want to reduce it 100%. It has to be that effective. And if you're feeling sorry for yourself, I have something to share with you. I guess everything in life is somewhat relative. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your interest. And I'm done.
Well, thank you very
We're
much.
We're on air, Chief.
thank you, Dr.
So
Padalecki. That was a tremendous presentation.
We
don't have time for questions, but I see that you left all of your contact info on the second slide, so I presume that means that people are welcome to contact you.
That was not a good career move, was it? whatever you can get hold of me, if you have something you would like to share, I would love to hear your success story.
Well, that's grand. Thank you.
Gotcha.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for joining us today. And Dr. Padalecki,
thank you very much, sir,
for a tremendous presentation.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
We'll talk to you all again very soon. Goodbye.